Hi, I'm Chuck Seckinger, and welcome to Labor Relation Gigs in Small Bites. In this podcast, we will concentrate on the union construction market and explain all you need to know to understand the labor relations practices that are so unique to this industry. And we'll do it one step at a time in small bites. So let's go. Hello, and welcome to episode 4 of Labor Relation Gigs in Small Bites. I'm going to be talking about an employer administration of a collective bargaining agreement on a construction project through the use of the CBA's management's rights provision, also the establishment of reasonable work rules that result in disciplinary action, and the due process that is part of the grievance procedure. As you would think, when an employer signs a collective bargaining agreement in the construction industry or in any industry, the employer is agreeing to certain terms and working conditions with their employees' designated union representatives. This would be things like wages and benefits, hours of work, overtime, shift, and many other conditions that I've talked about in previous episodes. All are written in the CBA, but what about certain management prerogatives that are not described in the CBA? In the construction industry, these are things like the type of materials to be used, the design of the project, the drawing specifications, or the number of employees. In reality, this is the right of management to run the project. In other words, the rights not bargained away or limited in the CBA are retained by the employer under the management's right provision as a common law employer. Here is an example of a typical management's rights provision that can be found in nearly all CBAs. It would say, the union recognizes that the employer shall have the sole responsibility for the management and operation of its business, the direction of the workforce, the right to maintain efficiency on its job by use of any machinery, tools, or labor-saving devices, and the right of employer to determine the number of employees required on each job, and to hire, promote, lay off, and discharge, suspend, or discipline employees for just cause, and or reject any employee referred to the union for a lawful, non-discriminatory reason subject to the provisions of this agreement. It is agreed that the rights enumerated above shall not be deemed to exclude other pre-existing rights of the employer not enumerated, which do not conflict with other provisions of this agreement. So, it is certainly true that the employer's rights to management, to direct where it involves wages, hours, and working conditions, is a procedural right, but it does not mean that those management rights are over and above labor's rights. True, someone must be the boss. Somebody has to run the project. People just can't decide for themselves what to do next. However, this does not imply a second-class role for the union. The union has every right to pursue its role of representation of its members with the same stature that is accorded to management. Over the years, management rights have been limited by the inroads the unions have made through legislation, the NLRB, collective bargaining, the grievance and arbitration process. In episode 1, we looked at how labor law has developed over the years through the National Labor Relations Act of 1935, Taft-Hartley Act, and the Lanham-Griffin Act, primarily. Cases decided by the NLRB and the courts have held, in addition to wages, hours, and work conditions, that mandatory bargaining was required for subjects like holidays, subcontracting, discharges, benefits, dues checkoffs, hiring halls, rest periods, placing existing past practices into the contract, work rules, and yes, even management rights, and many, many more. So what is an employer to do to control the workplace, to be productive with labor, and most importantly, to get the job done on time and on budget and make a profit and continue in the construction industry? As I have just talked about, the management rights provision in the CBA is not a silver bullet. My way or the highway does not play well in today's workplace. Employers bear too much responsibility and financial liability to ever consider returning to those days. In today's construction workplace, Order must be established through having in place fair and reasonable work rules that control employees' conduct with their supervision and coworkers, and providing a safety program to enforce safe work practices that keep workers away from hazards and protects company property and materials. Both the project's written work rules and safety rules are reinforced by employee orientation, worksite coaching, and if compliance becomes an issue, both sets of rules are backed up by progressive disciplinary action up to and including termination. Now, let's look at some of the typical work rules and safety rules that will be established on a construction site. A responsible employer will have a first day on the job orientation to go over safety work practices, distribute a pocket-sized work rule booklet, spend some time going over the rules, explain why they are necessary to keep order on the project, and define the consequences for violations. These job rules would first be reviewed with the union as part of a pre-job conference where the unions could make comment on them. Most collective bargaining agreements allow for the employer to establish reasonable job rules, which tend to be similar to other employers' job rules in the construction industry. If the employer needs to change or add to these job rules after the pre-job conference, then the employer must notify the union of the change in the rules, and again, the reasonable rule test would apply. Once these job rules are established, the employer must enforce them, the same for all employees on the project, without disparate treatment for some over other employees. In most cases, the employer will have a newly orientated employee to sign off on the work rule book that have been received, and the employer will store that document sign-off in the employee's personnel file, just in case there is an issue later on where the employee might claim that they were unaware of the rule. First and foremost is the prohibition of firearms, unprescribed drugs, and illegal contraband on a project site, and including the project's parking lots and residences, if any. Possession or use is subject to immediate termination for obvious reasons. These prohibitions are so necessary to have in place in any public or private workplace that is usually posted at the fence line or access point so as to inform the general public that may have business in the construction site that guns, drugs, and contraband are forbidden on the other side of the gate. In many cases, employers have set up lunchbox checks where site security requires workers to open their personal belongings being carried in and out of the project for their inspection. On some federal projects and all nuclear projects, there will be a metal detector and other devices set up at access points to prevent weapons from being carried into the workplace. In most cases, cars are not inspected on a daily basis. However, the employer's security force, in making their rounds, may visibly see weapons, ammunition, or drugs in a locked employee vehicle. Action can be taken under probable cause that a cardinal rule is being violated, and the employee may be required to open up their vehicle by security or law enforcement. These types of violations result in immediate termination and sometimes even arrest. Impairment on the project due to alcohol or drugs is a very serious infraction of the project work rules. This steps across all boundaries of responsibility for the employer to maintain a safe and productive workplace. Drinking or taking drugs during working hours or the time before is a willful act of insubordination and bad judgment that could jeopardize the safety of the employee, other workers, and company property. Sometimes this type of violation shows up when there is an accident or near accident on site and the employer's drug testing policy would come into play. For most cases, the appropriate discipline for impairment is immediate termination. However, with employee assistance programs run by both the employer and the union, some violators may be provided a route back to employment after a period of counseling with verified sobriety. Acts of dishonesty, such as stealing company tools and materials, false attendance punches, intentional falsification of company documents, intentionally damaging company property, all would be considered valid reasons for immediate dismissal and, in some cases, financial restitution. Insubordination is another violation of work rules that can take various forms but will almost always result in termination. Employees may hide their failure to meet their supervisor's orders or perform assigned work tasks by claiming that they did not understand what they were supposed to be doing, or by purposely wasting time before the task is completed. However, it is a different case when the employee confronts their supervisor with a straight-out failure to complete a clear and direct work order. The supervisor must be reserved and remain professional and seek another member of supervision to witness a potential confrontation and to intercede if necessary to allow the employee to consider the end result that would happen for an insubordinate act. If the refusal is because of a real or perceived unsafe condition, then the discussion should include the company's safety professional, and consideration should be made to conduct a thorough review of the case in question and address the concern on its merits, and perhaps without discipline being issued. Many employers in the construction industry give every employee the power to stop work when a safety concern is raised. Supervision must never disregard employees pulling out the stop work card. Not taking it seriously could erode their confidence in the safety program and result in some form of action outside the employer's control, such as an OSHA or whistleblower claim. While both forms are valuable, a more immediate way to resolve a safety claim would be with the parties that are on site and in control of the factors. Not all disciplinary action for job rule violations should result in termination. Most are minor infractions, such as tardiness, occasional absenteeism, not using the appropriate safe work practice, or not wearing the personal protection equipment. If these minor infractions keep reoccurring, then corrective action must be taken to ensure that employees are complying with the job rules. This corrective action would take shape in verbal and written warnings issued by supervision to the individual employee to establish a record of progressive discipline that the employer has taken to address these infractions. Say, for example, the job rules set the attendance policy for the project. Employees may be given a few occasions to be tardy or absent without prior notification to supervision without penalty. But when this happens without notification on a set number of times, then the supervisor would start by giving the employee a verbal warning, making note of it in the record as to the time and date of the verbal warning and the reason for the discipline. The employee is made aware that the verbal warning is a disciplinary step and that future similar conduct would result in further and more severe disciplinary action. If the conduct continues, then the supervisor may issue a written warning to the individual, and if need be for more of the same type of infractions, a final warning or suspension, with a final disciplinary action being termination for just cause, all as defined in the job rules. It is important to recognize that a disciplinary action is one step closer to a loss of employment for the employee. Therefore, an employee receiving the discipline would have every right to be represented by the job site steward at the issuance of the discipline by the supervision, or at the investigation meeting that the individual believes would lead to a disciplinary action being taken against them. Always err on the side of having a union steward present, and if one is not available because of a legitimate reason, such as a limited night shift coverage, then have a co-employee witness the meeting. Again, let me emphasize the importance of job rules, where infractions are written out and disciplinary actions are defined. Employees will receive these job rules on the first day of their employment during their site orientation and will be asked to sign off acknowledging the rules have been received and reviewed. A written record is most helpful in defending the employer's disciplinary decision. You may ask, how can the employer possibly define all violations to the job rules in one written document when there are possible infractions that have not even been contemplated but can end up being demonstrated on project and causing disruption to the order of common sense? In such cases, the job rules may state that a full enumeration of reasons for disciplinary action is not possible, but management reserves the right to discipline such conduct not enumerated based on their determination of the severity of the action that impacts the safety and security of employees and property. Think of the use of cell phones 10 years ago. No rule was in place then because cell phones were not as pervasive in the world as they are today. You heard me say that reasonable work rules and just cause was needed for management to enforce discipline on a project site and to administer those rules without disparate treatment towards any employee. Unions are part of the process to determine in each individual case if the employer took the appropriate disciplinary action and met the requirements in the CBA for administering the disciplinary action against their members for just cause. The burden of proof of just cause is always on the employer. As the exclusive representative of their members, the union has the burden to fairly represent them in the grievance procedure or chance being subject to internal charges from their internationals or even unfair labor practices through NLRB charges by their members against the union. Any challenge to the employer's authority to manage their project usually ends up in the grievance procedure, which is my next topic. You will note that a large chunk of any CBA is the grievance procedure, and it usually takes up an entire article in the agreement. What is the grievance procedure and why is it so important? Some labor relations professionals will tell you that without the grievance procedure, the employer and the union have no other recourse than to resort to work stoppages, picketing, and strikes and lockouts to resolve their differences. Since most CBAs include an article that prohibits the parties from wildcat strikes, work interruptions, and lockouts during the term of the agreement, the trade-off for the protection is the grievance procedure, where the parties can address their day-to-day issues that arise regarding just cause and contract interpretations. In other words, a continuous collective bargaining process. What is grievable under the CBA? Certainly a disciplinary action for just cause is grievable, but what about matters that are more like a gripe or a complaint about a worksite or supervision? Is there a specific article and section that a grievant can cite as a violation? Is it more a question of interpretation of some language in the CBA? The answer is that most likely all of the above just mentioned are grievable matters under the grievance procedure. A careful reading of the article of the grievance procedure in the CBA should always be made before accepting agreements. Who can initiate agreements? Only a union steward can, as an exclusive representative of the employee. The employee cannot submit agreements without the union, and the employer cannot address an employee grievance without the union. The grievance procedure comes in all types of configurations, but mostly it has three steps that will conclude with arbitration as necessary for unresolved issues from the lower steps. The first step is generally at the project level with the employer's superintendent representing the company and the union's job site steward representing the members and the union's interest. There is usually a time limit a grievance can start, starting with the point the issue was discovered or reasonably could have been discovered by the employee to having the first step meeting. Many times this step is left to be an informal step with no written agreement submitted. The parties will meet at an agreed upon time and place on the project and on company time. For an example, let's say the employee, a carpenter, was given a written warning for poor attendance on Thursday. If there is a 5-day limit on raising an issue to the grievance procedure, then the carpenter would have until the next Thursday to bring the issue forward to management's attention through his carpenter steward. After the issue is acknowledged, the steward and the superintendent may have another 5 days to resolve the grievance. If the superintendent answers grievance denied because the written warning was for just cause and was in accordance with the job rules, and the union does not agree, then the union and the grievant may reduce the grievance to writing, usually on the prescribed grievance form, and submit the written grievance to step two. The next step may also have a 5 working day time limit to resolve the grievance. This time, the contending parties may be the union's business manager and the employer's labor relations manager. If again the company determines the grievance is without merit and no resolution is found, then the union may move it to the third step, which could be a committee of union and employer participants, depending upon the CBA, or if there is no committee step, then the union may move the grievance to arbitration. Now, the paramount step in the grievance procedure is arbitration. Let's take a step back from where we are now and look back to where we started out in this episode, management's rights. An agreement to arbitrate is essentially a complete surrender by the employer to determine a controversy by unilateral action. Also, in the United States, the right to strike is looked upon as an essential economic freedom. Both the employer and the union leave their rights at the order of arbitration and place the resolution of the issue up to the facts they present to the sober judgment of the arbitrator. The way an arbitrator is picked for a grievance hearing is defined in the CBA. It is either through a list requested by the parties from the American Arbitration Association, where the employer and the union strike names off the list until only one remains, or by naming a permanent arbitrator in the CBA. This permanent arbitrator is usually based on a qualified person that has great familiarity with the construction industry and one that both parties trust enough to name in the CBA. When the union has moved the grievance to arbitration, they are doing it knowing full well there is a formal process ahead, much like a courtroom where evidence can be submitted through testimony of witnesses that are subject to cross-examination. In most cases, both parties are represented by attorneys, and there will be a transcript, closing brief, and at the end, a settlement ruling from the arbitrator that is final and binding and cannot be appealed through the court system, which gives great deference to the arbitration process. The cost of the arbitrator is usually shared by both parties, but their legal fees are individual and not shared. And the hearing, which could take one day or more, can be quite substantial. Also, the arbitrator ruling could mean everlasting precedent for similar issues in the future. This outcome weighs heavily on each party and can result in the employer and the union settling the grievance prior to arbitration. In other words, the arbitration step should not be taken lightly by either party. To sum up this episode, I have told you about how management rights is not a silver bullet for employers to infringe on rights of the union. This is a subject regarding the balance of management rights to union rights that has been in discussion in our economy since the mid-1800s and most likely will be for the next 200 years or more. Rulings from the NLRB, labor legislation, anti-labor legislation, organizing drives in new markets like Amazon and Starbucks, all are subject to the political winds of change. For our purpose in construction, the labor relations in the industry has seen many approaches and periods of change with different levels of union participation and political influence over the years. In the next episode, I will talk about the structure of the union shop, merit shop, and open shop construction markets and provide you with an understanding on the regionality and scope of these separate markets and how they are in play in our ever-changing economy. Thank you again for listening, and come back for Episode 5, Construction Approaches in the U.S. Economy. Until then, be safe and be kind. Reference for this episode number 4, How Arbitration Works, 4th edition, Frank L. Corey and Edna Asper L. Corey, Bureau of National Affairs, Inc., 1987. I'm Chuck Seckinger, Principal Consultant with Labor Relations Gigs. You can find more episodes at www.laborrelationgigs.com. Thank you for listening. Bye.